This is The Takeaway for July 8th, 2015.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we begin with an old song that it turns out has some new lyrics.
Fear not, young man or woman. I'll be waiting at the gate. And don't be afraid. Don't run. I'll not chase. Sure, my name is Elwin, and you'll be back for a taste. Behold, you're hooked.
The late James Brown's King Heroin. We are reminded today that it is still king, with no sign of being deposed. There will be a record harvest of opium this year, despite the more than $680 billion being spent on the war in Afghanistan. And that's just one reason why heroin addiction rates are up by 150% in the U.S. since 2007. Heroin has spread to new groups, women and non-Hispanic whites. Heroin is not only more prevalent, it's more dangerous these days. It's purer in its street-available forms than ever before. The number of deaths due to heroin has nearly quadrupled in the last decade, and among them, the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, whose death in February of last year, it turned out, was not some simple story of celebrity excess. A new Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report published yesterday details heroin's return and spread. CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden took some time today to underscore with us a public health issue that he finds deeply frustrating on many levels.
There's a big increase, it's rapid, and it's through many parts of society. It's the result of a 1-2 punch. Too many Americans primed for heroin addiction by excessive use of prescription opiates and then an influx of cheaper, more accessible heroin.
And let's take the first one. What would you say is the sociological reason for the first, and how would you combat it as a public health matter?
There are doctor factors or prescriber factors and patient factors. For doctors, there is the fact that for a generation, doctors were taught that we were under-treating pain, which was true for some patients, and we didn't adequately recognize the harms and the risks of prescription opiates. They're highly addictive drugs. You take a few pills and you can be addicted for life, and they're highly lethal drugs. You take a few too many and you can die. There are some patients for whom they're very important. Someone who's got severe pain with untreatable cancer, you absolutely want that person to have all of the pain relief they can get. But for a chronic pain condition, back pain, headaches, these are not good drugs. There are better drugs. There are better treatment modalities. On the part of patients, to understand that treating causes sometimes can take longer but be much more effective than treating symptoms.
So the idea that Philip Seymour Hoffman took a few prescription opiates and ended up back on heroin and then died, it's not too extreme to say that opiates, prescription opiates, are a very dangerous gateway drug to something that might result in death.
Absolutely. In fact, in one study, about three-quarters of people using heroin started with prescription opiates. So to prevent people from starting to use heroin, we need to improve prescribing patterns for opioid painkillers.
And we've always known that heroin is dangerous and highly addictive. Is there something about heroin that allows people to take a step that might 20 years ago have seemed much more draconian? It's just a much easier step to take now?
A few things are going on. When I became a doctor in the 1980s in New York City, a whole generation, mostly of men and some women, were dying from HIV, from injection drug use, mostly with heroin. That generation died out, and some of the memory of what injection drug use causes has died out as well. We saw this horrific outbreak of HIV in southern Indiana in the past year, with large number of people infected with HIV and hepatitis C through injection drug use. Heroin can be highly potent. It can vary in potency, so a dose that might not be lethal one day may be lethal the next day with a different batch. And the route of administration allows a very high concentration immediately that can result in death.
Dr. Frieden, I have nothing but the greatest respect for you, but I'm going to proceed with this line of questionings at the risk of sort of ruining the rest of your day. You are certainly someone who works in the administration. How big is the budget of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention?
Our budget is about $7 billion if you look at the what's called discretionary budget.
$7 billion. How much does it frustrate you to understand that the U.S. has spent $685.6 billion in Afghanistan and that this year will be the record harvest of heroin in Afghanistan, and that that bears almost directly on the second factor that you spoke about, the access to heroin in the United States?
What we're doing with this initiative is first saying, what can we do in the healthcare system? We can prevent people from starting heroin by improving prescribing patterns. We can increase access to methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone. These are evidence-based treatments for heroin addiction. And we can improve the reversal of heroin overdoses by expanding use of naloxone or Narcan. In addition, we're working increasingly with the Drug Enforcement Administration and with state and local drug enforcement programs to figure out where it's happening, when it's happening, to provide real-time information on trends. Because if we decrease the supply of heroin, we will decrease the use of heroin. If we increase the cost and the difficulty getting it, we will decrease the number of people who use it and who die from it.
How are we going to decrease that availability of heroin unless you have a seat at the table next to the generals of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with the President Obama saying that the casualties from the heroin addiction in the United States are casualties of war?
There's a broad commitment to addressing this problem both within the administration and a bipartisan commitment of Congress. We want to address every aspect that's driving this problem.
Does the president get it?
I think the president is very concerned about this issue. We are hearing this from all over the country, all different groups. That's why in this year's budget, which Congress is now debating, there's a large increase to address not just prescription drug abuse, but also heroin overdose.
Dr. Thomas Frieden is director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, commenting on the statistics out of the CDC on heroin addiction rates in the United States. Thanks so much, doctor.
Thank you very much.
The increase in addiction rates nationally multiplies the number of individual struggles with heroin, which medically and psychologically is among the most challenging and devastating life events there is, with complicated impacts on self-esteem, family members, mental acuity, and no known foolproof cure. Seth Mnookin was addicted to heroin from 1995 to 1997. He's now nearly 20 years sober and is the associate director of MIT's graduate program in science writing. Seth, welcome to The Takeaway.
John, thanks so much for having me.
What do you hear when you hear these rates of addiction climbing so dramatically in the United States? How does it make you feel in terms of all the individual faces out there that are going through what you are going through and have gone through?
I guess the main reaction is one of sadness. I mean, it's such a difficult disease. It's such a painful addiction. And I know families so often feel completely blindsided when they have to deal with this. And again, as the heroin rates have been climbing, I read and I hear about these stories of families that are torn apart, of parents and grandparents trying to figure out what they can do for their children and not having any really clear answers.
So there's a low-income component to these numbers, but there's also something absolutely universal about the addiction and its impact on individuals and family members. Could you sort through those a little bit? I know you're focused much more on the individual sort of brain impacts, but just give us a sense that what you went through is not unusual.
No, I think that's right. And one of the things that I think is interesting about these numbers is that while it continues to be a problem that is felt disproportionately by lower-income people, by non-whites, by people without private insurance, we do see that changing a little bit. And there are increasing rates across society. And I think what that shows really clearly is that this is not a problem that only affects one group of people. As heroin becomes easier to get, I think that we're seeing across all socioeconomic, across all racial groups, how dangerous an addiction this can be and how gripping it can be for people.
You wrote about the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman and how it came out of nowhere for him, and in a sense for you. You've been sober for 20 years. You make the point that there is no past tense in being addicted. It's something you're dealing with now. Why does that scare you, and why does it make you feel as though there's no out of the woods here?
Well, because, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman was someone who obviously had a brilliant career. He had a young family. He had everything to live for. And it was so painful and scary for me because, you know, as you said, I'm coming up on 18 years sober. And there are times when I feel like, all right, well, that's a good chunk of time. I have a family of my own. I'm pretty secure. And what it reminded me of was that, you know, one false step. And it's not as if then I start the path to addiction again. It's as if those 18 years never happened.
What are the scariest moments? What are the footfalls on that stairway that are particularly rickety for you? Can you take me there?
There's nothing in my life on a daily basis that I can do to sort of, I guess, take the edge off. You know, I don't come home and have a glass of wine. The scariest moments are not moments when something really difficult is going on in my life, because then my guard tends to be up. The scariest moments are, you know, maybe when I'm just a little bit stressed or overtired, and I realize almost on a subconscious level that I really want something just to kind of make everything a little bit easier.
What do you think explains the experience of your family staying together? Do you think the fact that your family has stuck with you is simply a matter of them going, well, he's sick, we're not going to leave him while he's sick, or is it bigger than that?
Actually, at the very end of my addiction, my family sort of said that they couldn't stick by me anymore. You know, they said that they hoped that I got clean, but that the effect that I was having on them as a family was too painful and too difficult. You know, there was a period where I have a younger brother and sister. Everyone had to be in touch with my parents every day to make sure that nothing had happened to me. And I was just ripping the family apart. And so eventually they said, we hope you get better. And if and when you do get better, we want to hear from you. But we can't be involved in your life on a day-to-day basis. And on some level, I think that really helped me. It's impossible for me to know what eventually did help me to gain my sobriety, but I think that was probably a factor.
Seth Mnookin is associate director of MIT's graduate program in science writing. His most recent book is The Panic Virus, the true story behind the vaccine autism controversy. Thanks again, Seth.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
European leaders, you might say, are on Greek time this week. Following the weekend referendum, the Greek government is going to make sure it is able to offer realistic proposals this time around so that the debt crisis can be addressed once and for all. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras addressed the European Parliament in Strasbourg, France today.
We are determined not to have a clash with Europe, but to tackle head on the establishment in our country and to change the mindsets which have taken us and taken the Eurozone down.
Greece has requested a 3-year bailout from the Eurozone's rescue fund and has committed to start implementing some of the overhauls demanded by creditors by early next week. Athens has been given until Sunday to come up with a full reform plan in return for loans that will keep the country from having to leave the euro and find another currency. Constanze Stelzenmüller is the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Constanze, what is the perspective of Germany on this, if you could sum it up for us?
Well, I think we have to make a distinction between the German government and the German public, although there is a significant overlap, I will say that. Chancellor Merkel and her finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, are taking a fairly stiff position on this and have throughout the crisis, which is that they want to see a real, significant and credible reform package before they're willing to extend debt and consider relief packages.
Isn't there a broad historical perspective here for Germany in the sense that post-World War II, it was all about debt forgiveness. It was all about generous terms for financing, et cetera, to stimulate the German economy, a different situation to be sure than Greece. But I'm wondering if there's a lesson here that the Germans are missing, a lesson that even is relevant in the absorption of East Germany much, much more recently.
You know, I think you can assume that the Germans know their own country's history. And the arguments that the Germans are making, I would like to say outright, I'm critical of the Eurozone's and my own German government's rigidity and lack of flexibility over the past 4 years. I do think that it is slightly misses the point to harp on Germany's history after the war. The situation just, in my view, isn't comparable. And the other thing, if I may say so, I've just spent a month in Europe, the entire month of June. I was in Sweden, in Greece, in Poland, and in Germany. And if you think the Germans are the tough ones on this one, you should hear the Swedes, the Norwegians, the Lithuanians, the Poles, and others who are incredibly upset with the Greeks and are saying, we went through these rigorous austerity programs because and these reform programs because we knew we had these dysfunctional post-communist state structures, certainly in East Europe. And we knew we needed to change that. And we knew we needed to adapt to make ourselves less vulnerable. So I think, you know, the Germans are actually the ones trying to hold this together. I was told over and over again in other countries in Europe in my travels, why don't you just throw the Greeks out? And I would say, listen, that is not how Europe works. I mean, in the end, it has to be solidarity. And I do think, you know, you should give the German government credit at least for wanting that, for being very clear on that. And I personally think there will be some debt relief in the end, and there certainly will be growth programs.
I'm wondering if the argument, and I'll refer back to the history of the absorption of East Germany post the wall coming down, as an argument for political union. The only way Germans were able to tolerate the sacrifices that were required to bring East Germany into Germany as a whole was because there was political unity. The fact that Greece is outside the political sort of notion of Europe, even though it's inside the euro, means that this is going to be a much more rocky road going forward.
No, and I think that's a really, forgive me, but I think that's a really skewed historical example. A, Helmut Kohl famously told the West Germans in 1989-90, there will be flowering landscapes, blühende Landschaften, and it won't cost us a dime. Yeah, famous last words, it cost us 20 billion over, I think, 20 years. That's the calculations made by reputable economists. And I wonder, had the West Germans been told this 25 years ago, whether they would have gone down that road, frankly.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So political union is not that big of a deal here?
Well, look, seriously, again, I think this slightly misses the point. The Greeks aren't East Germany and shouldn't be compared with that. I think they'd be furious to hear it. And I think if I subscribe to that example, I would be, you know, rightly considered to be, you know, presumptuous and condescending. But the Greeks joined the EU in 1981, are considered, I think, by all Europeans as core to the history and to the current meaning of the European Union. They have a key geopolitical importance, particularly now that conflicts are on the rise in the south and southeast of Europe, in the Middle East and in Northern Africa. They're key for pipelines, they're key for immigration, they're key for relations with Turkey, they're key for relations with Russia. I mean, they are geopolitically relevant in many ways, and there is a distinct realist interest in keeping the Greeks in the Eurozone and in the EU.
Are the sacrifices that are to come not politically viable, as far as you can tell, or is it just going to be a lot of noise and then things will settle down?
Look, my personal take on this is that all of the European leaders on the other side of the table from the Greeks have domestic populist movements, extremist movements who are thrilled by the prospect of a challenge to the European project, its legitimacy, validity, social fairness, and who are going to town on this. And some of them are, you know, right wing, and some of them are fascist, like Francis Marine Le Pen, who congratulated Tsipras after the no referendum. That is, I would suggest, not the kind of company you want to keep in Europe.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Constanze, thanks so much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Later this hour, Bash the Trash. It's a band that uses trash for instruments. We asked you to tell us how you've turned someone else's trash into treasure in your life.
Hi, my name is Katie. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. One day when I was wandering around in a magazine shop in Portland, Oregon, I came across a January 29th, 1955 issue of The New Yorker. Flipping through it, I realized that it contained the original printing of my favorite J.D. Salinger story, Branny. I bought the old magazine for just $3, but it is still one of my most prized possessions.
So this is Roxanne from Atlanta. There are a lot of treasures in trash, from renovating my kitchen with cabinets from Habitat Restore to my child's closet. We live on the hidden treasures other people have purged from their home.
Salvage the conversation, won't you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. More coming up.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And LegalZoom, for over 10 years working to help Americans navigate the legal system with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Hey, Velvet Underground, what's not to love about the sun, for heaven's sakes? Solar energy, the success of the all-sun-powered solar impulse airplane notwithstanding, is having a moment these days. The cost of solar panels has dropped by almost 70% over the past 5 years. Financing for fitting residential buildings with solar power has made it an option for more and more Americans. In June, the president pledged that the U.S. would get at least 20% of its electricity from renewable sources by 2030, and he announced a new program this week to bring solar power to more low-income Americans. Who can argue with solar? Low maintenance, no pollution, completely renewable. One of the most radical qualities of solar panels, though, has nothing to do with the sun. They are decentralized point-of-use power sources that say the days of the giant centralized power plant, gas-powered, oil-powered, coal-powered, nuclear-powered, even hydro and wind, may be numbered. They certainly have some efficiency problems. And joining us is Amit Ronan, who's director of the George Washington Solar Institute and a former policy analyst with the U.S. Department of Energy. Amit Ronan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Does this explain why utilities are suspicious or concerned about the proliferation of solar energy, in that they really raise this issue of decentralized power, which is not something that's talked about very much?
Well, that's certainly part of the dynamic that's going on. Solar's having a moment for sure. They were 51% of all the new electric generation that was put online in the first quarter of this year, but they're still only 1% of the U.S. energy supply. But I think we are, as you we're indicating, beginning to see a tectonic shift in how we generate and consume electricity. So the price of solar energy has declined so quickly, as you'd mentioned, it's now becoming increasingly competitive, and in many cases cheaper than what you would cost you to buy from your local utility. So that's certainly a threat to this century-old business model where utilities typically built big centralized facilities powered usually by fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, nuclear in some cases, and then they would wheel that power to you and you would pay as you use it. So that's a very different model from rooftop solar, where a homeowner can generate power on site where they use it. The financing, as you mentioned, is important too, because the homeowner, instead of paying for electricity bit by bit, you're paying a lump sum up front, but then you're getting fuel-free electricity for the next couple decades.
There are all kinds of designs of energy production and energy use that really clash with the traditional notion of Americans that power just comes out of the plug there. It's just a kind of a spigot that we don't really think about where it comes from. I mean, are there ways in which we could decentralize our use of power in ways even beyond solar that would reduce our energy use, because the cost of transmission is significant?
That's right. There's certainly a tax and a reduction in efficiency when you transmit over long distances. And there's lots of technologies that are coming online now that enable a lot of what you're talking about. So we got storage. There was a big announcement from Tesla about having people could have their own storage batteries in their basement and maybe disconnect from the grid entirely. So they put power in there when they got excess. If they need it, they pull it away. Right now, most people with rooftop solar are effectively using the grid as a giant battery. So that's one example. There's combination hybrid systems where you combine your water heating, which is another big energy user in your home that's not typically related to electricity. So there's a lot of exciting things going on. And the interesting thing, too, is there's a lot of studies that show that once people are more aware of their electricity use, they become much smarter about it.
Can you change your centralized notions of where energy comes from by using other things than solar? You mentioned hybrid. Are there ways to use generators that actually do use fossil fuels that would increase the efficiency and allow people to come off the grid? Or are fossil fuels by their nature centralized power plant options?
Typically, for the fossil fuel model, it's going to be more practical and efficient and cost-effective to use it in a centralized facility. So at-home generators usually are more in maybe an emergency situation, or if there's a reliability in your local region. There are some more efficient units that are coming online where you're essentially a small box in your home could provide your electricity and your hot water in the same power plant, and it's usually powered by natural gas, but more people are looking at options that are renewable because there's obviously a larger push to decarbonize our economy as making a lot more sense.
Can the utilities, because they're suspicious and have expressed some reservations about this, enforce a kind of stay-on-the-grid policy? Can they keep this trend from developing here in the United States?
Well, first, there's a lot of diversity in utilities general. We got 3,000 utilities, but by and large, they certainly are doing all that they can to try and slow this movement to distributed generation. You know, we have a century of existing regulatory and legal regime that all points to the old system, and that makes it hard for new entrants to battle this incumbent system where the centralized model and move away from that. So we're seeing battles, and we have a 50-state electricity policy by the way that it was developed over time. So we're seeing battles at the state, every state practically right now, particularly where in the solar case where solar penetrations are higher, is that where you see more utilities pushing back, trying to impose additional fees for solar users, all sorts of stuff.
Well, the idea of thinking about where power comes from, getting smarter about power, is certainly one of the trends that's probably not reversible. Amit Ronan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Amit Ronan is director of the George Washington Solar Institute and a former policy analyst with the U.S. Department of Energy.
Little darling, it's been a long, long, lonely winter. Little darling, it seems like years since it's been here.
You can turn the sun into electrical energy, and we learn in a moment that you can turn old plumbing into a musical instrument. And we're hearing from so many of you glorious garbage watchers.
Hi, I'm Andy from Louisville, Kentucky. I'd just like to say there are so many times that I've pulled stuff out of people's garbage. 14-karat gold Gucci necklace with 2 quarter-karat diamonds in it. 32-inch TV with no problems whatsoever. At least 30 fishing poles. A toolbox that was full of tools, many lawnmowers, weed eaters, 15 10-speed bikes. When I was younger, I found 12 years of Playboy magazine, and I sold them to a collector for $150, and that was back in 1981.
Daytona Beach, Florida. I adopted a throwaway mama pit bull who had ended up emaciated and in the local shelter and turned her into a healthy, treasured member of my family. Reuse your thoughts and send them to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org. Hey, whose garbage music is that? Could we meet the band here?
So I'm John Bertels, and I'm the co-director and co-founder of Bash the Trash Environmental Arts.
I'm Karina Piaggio, so I play the bang cello, the balloon flute, the metal strip, cardboard tubes, and other assorted trash little thingies.
I am Martine Urbach, and I am the percussionist du jour, kitchen sink explorer, and pun master.
My name is Erica Capin, and I'm the first styrolinist and string specialist.
These are four members of the group, Bash the Trash. John and Karina are married, so are Martin and Erica. Their school workshops, instructional videos, and live performances all deliver the musical message that you can make music out of any object you have around. It's an argument for playing together to bring more joy to the world, and an argument for recycling to make the planet healthier.
Bash the Trash came about 25 years ago, and I'd always been experimenting with strange musical instruments even as a kid. And I mean, originally I wanted to play all the musical instruments in the orchestra, but I mean, instruments are expensive and they're hard to come by, and people don't want you to play on their brass instruments, for example. So I began to realize that there were instruments all around us. And like down in the basement of my house, I found there was a big sheet of metal. And if I shook the sheet of metal, it made a sound kind of like thunder. My brother had some weights downstairs as well. And each different size of those weight bars made a different sound when I hit on them. And that started me thinking about the different possibilities of sound. And this sort of led me to think about how can we deal with this recycling? How can we deal with environment in here in New York City? How can we teach kids how to do that? And that was kind of the nascent thing, because New York City was just at that point beginning their recycling program. And we started to sort of highlight how to do environmental stuff, how to do environmental programming that way.
Karina, how does the recycling piece and the music piece mix?
It's all a big part of a circus. And the recycling thing comes because, and I think this is common to all of us, we are quite passionate about the environment and all living things. And there's obviously a big problem with garbage and with everything we use and throw away so happily, especially in this country. It all fits together. Instead of throwing this out, I'm going to see if I can do something with it. What we do is we make musical instruments. But that is not necessarily all that can be done. I mean, we have even seen kids do amazing things with stuff, with garbage. Usually kids tend to do artworks. But my hope is that somebody will pick up this concept, and I know many people have, because now we can find out what people are doing around the world, and do something useful with it. So everything is part of the same. Recycling, music, using instead of throwing it out in nature. It's all part of the same.
A lot of what Basha Trash does is we do assembly performances in schools all over the country, but we also do workshops in the classroom in which we both show up with specific instruments and we teach the children the science of sound and also the physics of the instruments. So we teach children how the instruments work.
Now, it is important when you're making a trombone that you have different size tubes that fit together pretty tightly.
And we also show up with humongous garbage bags and say, hey, you now know exactly the physics of it. You know how the instruments work. You have 30 minutes. Come up with instruments that nobody's seen before. And time again, I see instruments that I literally have never seen before.
Right.
I would see an instrument that incorporates rubber bands for strings, shakers for percussion instruments, and double reeds for woodwinds. And I'm like, what is that? And they say, well, this is a photomonometrone. I was like, well, what does it do? Well, I show it to you. And literally, we have kids that have never played music that are jamming on multiple families of instruments at the same time.
What are the rich musical veins of Trash that are particularly valuable?
Sure. Well, you know, we usually talk about all the families of instruments. So rubber band demonstrates the string family. We talk about percussion and all different kinds of things like you can use for percussion. Drums made out of coffee cans. It can be a metal drum. It can be a plastic drum if you hit the lid, and then it can be a guido and a maraca if you fill it and scrape it. We always go over the major families of instruments and then talk about the physics behind it, with long things or bigger things making lower sounds, and then shorter things or smaller things making higher sounds, and then we show with different materials how that applies to all the families of instruments.
Now, it's great what you're doing. I absolutely love it. But in thinking in broad terms about the environment, I mean, if you could make an instrument out of, you know, old diapers, or, you know, that's a serious problem of landfill, you know, that would be great. Or like those little styrofoam peanuts and stuff.
Well, we haven't, because we haven't found the way of making it sound. But if we are successful in, because we...
You'll go there.
Somebody will.
Yeah.
Somebody will pick up where we left off and use those peanuts and use those diapers. Maybe not to make instruments. I haven't found any way that a diaper can make music.
Yeah. But we got challenged on that the other day, as a matter of fact.
We were in Central Park, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. We were at a gig, and a guy said, can you make something out of this old diaper? And we were like, eh.
What are the names of the tunes that you played?
This is all from a suite called Tiny Sounds, and it was all just meant as an improvisation. Basically, the idea is you put a bunch of instruments in front of you, a big pile of instruments, and you choose whatever you feel like playing at the moment and then improvise with those instruments.
And you build on the first person that starts playing. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Yeah. But that is part of it.
You were the composer who dreamed of playing all the instruments in the orchestra and found trash. You are the choreographer who dreamed of joining the circus and found trash.
Right.
What did you dream of?
I've dreamt of playing the drums all my life and teaching children how to do it. So now I have a master's degree in jazz drumming and in early childhood education. So I teach elementary school.
I dreamt of improvising on the violin in jazz and different types of folk music. And I found a styrofoam violin in trash.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The members of Bash the Trash joined us live in CR4. You can hear full tracks at thetakeaway.org and see a video of the band playing their unusual and very inventive instruments. And here's something to take with you today. I have absolutely no chance of taking over as Mr. Burns on The Simpsons.
Are you saying boo or Burns?
Boo!
I was saying Burns.
That's right, Harry Shearer is back in the cast of the longest-running show in television. After delivering a very hairy ultimatum several months ago, he signed his contract yesterday. Harry Shearer is back with The Simpsons for another 2 or 3 years or so. All is right with the world. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your Mr. Burns impressions or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.